welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, August the 10th, and I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And the headline says, Council awards $2.3 million contract for Pierce Street water main replacement. And this article was written by reporter Dolly Butts. The Sioux City Council awarded a $2.5 million contract to an engineering company this past Monday for the construction of the Pierce Street water main replacement. The City Council's vote was 4-0 in favor of giving the project to Sioux City Engineering Company. Councilwoman Julie Chenor was absent. Sioux City Engineering Company submitted the loan bid for the project, $2,336,187. Now, that bid was nearly 37% above the engineer's estimate of $1,725,000. The project includes the replacement of the existing water main on Pierce Street, from 5th Street to 7th Street, abandonment of combined sewers, and replacement of street paving for utility repairs. "We're not saving anything here," Mayor Bob Scott remarked before the vote. "We're not if they meet the incentive, no," Public Works Director Dave Carney responded. He continues, "We tried to do something different, and we thought we'd get more bidders. We were disappointed. There is a $100,000 incentive to complete work in stage one of the contract before November 23rd, and another $100,000 incentive for project completion before July 3rd of 2023. The project has a late start date of May 15, 2023, and is being funded with American Rescue Plan Act dollars. That's why the contract is what it is. If they don't get those incentives already in the contract price, it'll be taken out if they don't meet the incentive, so we don't have to allocate those funds later," Carney explained. Mayor Pro Tem Dan Moore asked Carney if Sioux City Engineering Company can continue working on the project through the winter months, depending on the weather. "Most likely, I think they take a winter shutdown and then start back up in the spring. They're probably not going to want to do it in the wintertime," said Carney, who noted that contractors will be taking up one lane of traffic. On June 27th of this year, the City Council voted 4-1 to adopt plans, specifications, form of contract, and estimated cost for the project. Scott cast the low no vote, and he did so noting that the city could have bid it a lot earlier. A 110-plus-year-old cast-iron water main broke near the intersection of 5th and Pierce Streets on June 23rd. The water main has suffered at least three breaks in the past year or so, with two of those being directly in front of the Orpheum Theater. After the latest break, the Orpheum and Alf's downtown library lost running water, and the fire suppression system of the theater and the Francis Building were down. A stretch of Pierce Street was reduced to one lane as a result. Headline: School Board Seeking Applicants to Fill Albert's Term. And this article was written by reporter Earl Horlick. The Sioux City School Board will be accepting applications to fill the term of board member Jalene Albert. Albert resigned from her seat last week, effective immediately due to family reasons. She's employed as the Vice President of Learning at Western Iowa Tech Community College. Albert was elected to the school board in 2019, and her term was to end in November 2023. According to Board President Dan Greenwell, the district has 30 days to fill Albert's vacancy, and people will have until August 19th to submit applications with the school district. We're looking for applicants who have many experiences in education or financial matters, Greenwell said moments after the school board's Monday night meeting. Applicants will be invited to speak and answer questions from the school board at its next meeting on August 22nd. And the board will then have until September 2nd to select a person to fill the remainder of Albert's term. And if the board cannot make up its mind on a successor for Albert, a special election will need to be held. Those seeking the seat in a special election will have to supply nomination papers with more than 1,800 signatures. According to Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill, it would cost the school district around $20,000 to $25,000 to host and hold the special election. And Greenwell said a special election can take place 4 weeks prior or 4 weeks after the November 8th general election. That means we're looking for maybe mid to late December at the earliest date for a special election, he said. And so a board appointment would be our preferred action. Headline: University of Iowa business with new Regents Company topped $125,000 over 3 years. And this news story was written by Vanessa Miller of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Iowa City. Over the last 3 years, the University of Iowa spent or committed to spending a total of $125,899 with Des Moines-based Seneca Companies, for which Iowa's newest member of the Iowa Board of Regents serves as president and chief operating officer. Iowa State University, another one of Iowa's three public universities governed by the 9-member volunteer board, has paid Seneca a modest $4,150 since the 2020 budget year. Meetings with the Board of Regents and other region universities will be held to determine the future business relationship with Seneca. And that's a quote from ISU Public Records Officer Ann Lellis. The University of Northern Iowa has not paid Seneca for any goods and services in the last 3 years. Much of the U of I payments to Seneca, a multi-pronged company serving the petroleum and fuel systems industry, has been for facilities-related maintenance, repairs, and installations on campus. The U of I, for example, reported a Seneca purchase order totaling $27,227 in October of 2021, for, quote, underground storage tank inspections, and another for $26,944 a month later for the replacement of E85 fueling equipment. The university paid Seneca $16,536 in December of 2020 to treat fuel in 9 tanks at the U of I hospitals and clinics and other campus facilities. ISU's purchases were for parts and repairs. James J.C. Ryswick, who Governor Kim Reynolds says was appointed to fill a region vacancy in June, has been president of Seneca since 2017, chief operating officer since 2016, and vice president of sales since 2013, according to his LinkedIn profile. Including previous possessions that he held at the company, Ryswick has spent more than 16 years with Seneca, which his father Chris Ryswick founded in 1972. Ryswick was appointed to fill the recent vacancy left by Milt Dakovich, who died February 24th of cancer. As Dakovich was reappointed to a second 6-year stint in 2019, the term Ryswick is filling runs through 2025, and he could be reappointed at that time. On Ryswick's Board of Regents Conflict of Interest Disclosure Form, which was filed July 20th, he listed his ownership of Seneca as a possible conflict, along with his service on the boards for Impact Iowa's Heroes. That's an organization created to support first responders and military couples. And ChildServe, that's a pediatric rehabilitation organization. And according to the region's conflict of interest policy, actual or potential member conflicts might include employment, ownership of, or service on the board of directors of an organization that has or may have relationships with the Board of Regents. Management of such conflicts include the required disclosure forms and consultation with the board office. Some interests can be handled with the disclosure alone. That's according to board policy. Others may require recusal from participation in certain matters, or in very unusual situations, divestiture of the interest or resignation from a conflicting position, the policy states. Board rules also note that any region with a direct or indirect interest in an entity or organization proposing to offer a product or service to the board or its universities, quote, shall not have access to any information regarding the proposed transaction or any competing entity that is not otherwise available to the public and or all entities competing under the proposed transaction. Ryswick is among several Republican members of the board who has made hefty donations in recent years to the Governor Kim Reynolds. Over the past 2 years, Ryswick has donated $59,517 in campaign contributions to Reynolds, $39,517 of which has been in-kind donations in the form of flights on his company's private airplane, like to and from Dubuque for the Field of Dreams game in August 2021. And the headline for this next article, Offutt Unit Marks 60 Years of Doomsday Mission. And this story was written by reporter Steve Lewer of the Omaha World Herald newspaper. 6 decades ago, the Strategic Air Command realized it needed a plane that could survive Armageddon. So SAC, headquartered at Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska, launched a program called the National Emergency Airborne Command Post, or Night Watch, in February of 1962. 3 4-engine KC-135A jets were modified with 12 state-of-the-art communication systems to serve as airborne command posts for the president and other top leaders in the event of nuclear war. And since then, the aircraft have just gotten bigger and the communication systems more sophisticated and numerous. But the planes and their crews still stand by 24/7 at Offutt and other sites, hoping that doomsday never arrives, but ready to carry on their duty if it does. And so this week, the 595th Command and Control Group, that's the Offutt-based unit that operates the fleet of 4 E-4B Night Watch jets, is celebrating its 60 years of service with a banquet Saturday at Omaha's CHI Health Center. We're honoring all the men and women who have served on it and the community that has supported it over 6 decades. That's according to Colonel Brian Golden, the 595th Group's commander. Former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, who also represented Nebraska in the U.S. Senate, will be the keynote speaker. Admiral Charles Richard, who heads U.S. Strategic Command, and General Anthony Cotton, the head of the Air Force Global Strike Command, are expected to be among the 760 guests. The unit has also been giving tours of its new 16 million E-4B flight simulator, which opened in May, at an industrial park in La Vista. It is the first time that Night Watch crews have had a dedicated simulator. Previously, the crews had been forced to travel to Denver or Miami for simulator training. More practice time also took place aboard the actual aircraft, which at $147,000 an hour is the Air Force's most expensive jet to fly. Simulator time, by comparison, costs only a few hundred dollars an hour. "We are fully utilizing this simulator," Golden said. "It's been amazing." In the late 1960s, the original KC-135 jets gave way to EC-135J aircraft, similar to the ones used for SAC's Cold War Command and Control Looking Glass. They were replaced by E-4As, which are modified versions of the commercial Boeing 747-200 in the late 1970s, and eventually upgraded to E-4B jets. The 595th Command and Control Group has endured a series of upheavals since the new unit was stood up in 2016 to take over the night watch mission from the 55th Wing. The following year, an EF-1 Tornado plane struck the Offutt flight line, causing $8.3 million in damage to two of the planes. The tornado already had overextended. It caused damage to the overextended fleet, left the fleet short for 2 months. And then in 2019, the 595th's hangar was damaged, and its offices and alert facility were wrecked during the massive flooding that left one-third of Offutt Air Force Base submerged for several weeks. And finally, a complete reconstruction of Offutt's runway, unrelated to the flood, forced the unit to temporarily move its flight operations to the Lincoln Airport in March of 2021. And now, as the Night Watch marks its 60th birthday, the unit and its mission are on the verge of more major changes. The 595th's leadership already has moved into the Riggs Building, the former home of SAC and STRATCOM, and now headquarters for the 55th Wing. Flight operations are expected to resume at Offutt on October 1st, with the completion of the runway rebuild. And within a few years, the 595th will have a brand new alert facility as a part of Offutt's post-flood reconstruction. And by the end of the decade, Golden said, the 595th Wing will begin fielding a new and larger fleet of planes called E-4Cs. The Air Force has specified that these new aircraft must be a commercial model and they have to have 4 engines apiece. And those limits mean it'll almost certainly be a Boeing 747-800 series, a newer version of the 747-200 series that has been in production since 2008. It is the only large 4-engine airliner currently in production. All others are twin-engine jets. Expanding the fleet won't come cheap. With the up-to-date electronic kit, each aircraft is expected to cost about $1.2 billion, Offutt said. And the headline for this next article, Omaha man charged with murder held without bail. An Omaha man charged with first-degree murder and sexual assault of a 58-year-old woman was ordered on Friday to be held without bail. Lorenzo Washington, 31, was arrested Wednesday in connection with the death of Rita Hash at an apartment near Maple Street and Maplewood Boulevard. During a court appearance on Friday, prosecutors said Hash was found dead from strangulation in her apartment on July 3rd. Witnesses reported seeing Washington and Hash together. Washington was charged with first-degree murder and first-degree sexual assault. Both are felony charges. He will appear in court next month. Headline for this next article, 3 burn in electrical incident at Google Center in Council Bluffs. 3 people sustained serious burns after an electrical incident at the Google Data Center located in Council Bluffs, according to Jim Wood, who is the assistant chief of the Council Bluffs Fire Department, First responders were dispatched to the data center at 11:59 a.m. to the report of an electrical event on the property. Scanner traffic heard indicates that there were initial reports of a large explosion, but Wood did not confirm any specifics. It was definitely some sort of electrical issue, he said. All three victims were taken to the Nebraska Medical Center. Two were taken by ambulance, while one person with critical injuries was taken by helicopter. All patients were awake and talking after the incident, according to Wood. Google's complex, located near Lake Manawa State Park, is one of the company's largest data centers. The centers are home to hundreds of supercomputers, which are high-tech computers used to store and process huge amount of information. The fire department is investigating what caused the incident. Headline for this next article: good inflation news. Online shopping prices are suddenly falling fast. And this story was written by reporter Matt Egan of the business section of CNN. E-commerce prices began rising in June of 2020, beginning an unprecedented stretch of 25 consecutive months of increases that underscored the severe price pressures hitting the U.S. economy. Well, that streak has finally ended. Online prices declined by 1% year over year in July, snapping a string of nearly 2 years of persistent inflation. And that's according to a new report released Tuesday by Adobe. The shift is even more pronounced on a month-over-month basis, where online prices dropped by 2% in July. The findings are good news for the inflation crisis, signaling a potential easing of the pricing pressures that have squeezed consumers and raised recession fears. Of course, it may take considerable time before inflation gets anywhere back to normal levels. And Adobe noted that online grocery prices, though, continue to surge. Consumer prices surged by 9.1% year over year in June, and that's the biggest increase in 40 years. And a new report due out is expected to show inflation eased in July, although it remained a very uncomfortably high 8.7%. And while cooling inflation would be a positive development, the factors behind the pricing shift online may not be great news. Adobe pointed to a combination of wavering consumer confidence and a pullback in spending, as well as on oversupply by some retailers. Walmart, Target, and Best Buy have all recently warned of an inventory glut that is eating into profits and prompting price cuts. The online deflation was led by a 9.3% year-over-year plunge in electronic prices, Adobe said, the area that consumers spend the most. Beyond electronics, prices online for toys fell sharply by 8.2% in July, and that's the largest drop for toys since 2019. Online prices for apparel rose 14 consecutive months until June, when they dipped to 0.1% year over year. That deflationary shift continued in July as online apparel prices fell by 1% over year and 6.3% month over month. Walmart in particular called out apparel as an area where the retail leader is being forced to mark down inventory, which is good, of course, for consumers, though. And the headline for this next article: Quad City Symphony Orchestra welcomes a new teaching artist. The Quad City Symphony Orchestra has announced the appointment of Kim Busick as violin-viola teaching artist. She will serve as an instructor for the group's private lesson program, the Suzuki-inspired group lesson program, and as a string specialist for the Quad City Symphony Youth Ensembles. Busick is a violinist, violist, and is a teacher who plays with orchestras all throughout the Midwest. She has served as a substitute violinist with the Quad City Symphony Orchestra since 2018. And the headline for this next article, Iowa metal manufacturer settles U.S. government complaint. A Southwest Iowa company that makes metal castings used by military contractors in helicopters and other equipment has reached a settlement in a lawsuit alleging the company failed to test the castings and falsely certified test results over the last 7 years. Wellman Dynamics, a Creston company that manufactures large metal castings used by military contractors, including Bell Helicopter, Sikorsky Aircraft, and Boeing Company, will pay $500,000 in restitution to the U.S. government to settle the allegations, court documents indicate. The lawsuit was filed in federal court against Wellman after employee Bradley Keller filed a complaint under the whistleblower provisions of the False Claims Act. Keller had worked in areas of the factory responsible for conducting various tests on the metal to ensure that it met quality standards. And he said, after he reported the improper testing and falsification of records between 2014 and 2021, he was laid off, but documents indicate he was later rehired. Keller will receive $90,000 out of the settlement amount under the whistleblower provisions of the False Claim Act. The company also must pay him $15,000 to settle a retaliation claim, and the company must pay his attorneys more than $63,000. A U.S. Department of Justice official said in a statement that proper testing is critical for ensuring the proper performance of the equipment. And in the settlement agreement, the company denied the allegations but indicated that the case was settled to avoid the delay, uncertainty, inconvenience, and expense of protracted litigation of the claims. The agreement signed with the United States Department of Justice also does not prevent the government from investigating further and pursuing criminal charges against some individuals if warranted. The company must cooperate with any such investigation. And the headline for this next article, during a retreat, Sioux City Council discusses fencing for new $7.5 million Grandview Park water tank. And this article was written by reporter Dolly Butts. The Sioux City Council discussed fencing in the new Grandview Park water tank with either a chain link or a wrought iron fencing during a recent meeting Wednesday at the Siouxland Expo Center. Sioux City Utilities Director Brad Poites told the council the tank structure itself is nearly complete. They painted, I believe, the second coat yesterday, or maybe they're on the second coat. But after the painting is done, they're done and gone, he said. The water lines are within feet of the tank, ready to be connected, and after that, it's just a matter of a little bit of beautification and getting a retaining wall up and getting everything in place. Since the city's investment is roughly $7.5 million with the new tank alone, Poets requested feedback on installing a fence. He said all of the city's other water assets are also protected by fencing. Two previous tanks in the park were built in the 1890s. The south tank was taken out of commission in 1993 after bulges were discovered in the structure. And throughout the years, prominent artists such as Paul Chelstad and Mark Kokin have painted images on the concrete walls. Music fans who were inspired by the annual Saturday in the Park Festival, which uses the park as its venue, also left anonymous art. I've had discussions about painting on the tank, and I'm perfectly fine with that, but I think it should be controlled and monitored, Poites said. And I think we should consider very strongly the possibility of putting a fence around that tank. It shouldn't affect any park activities. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper, dated Wednesday, August the 10th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now let's turn to today's obituaries. Kathleen Ann Dugan, 81, of Sioux City, died on Sunday, July 31st, from injuries suffered in an automobile accident, bringing an abrupt end to a life filled with faith, family, laughter, and love. Kathleen was born December 10th, 1940, to James F. Crowley and Rose E. Tiernan Crowley in Des Moines, Iowa. The fifth of the couple's nine children, Kathy spent parts of her childhood in Perry and Grimes, Iowa, before the family settled in a two-bedroom house in the Beaverdale neighborhood of Des Moines, Iowa. She attended Mercy Hospital School of Nursing and graduated as a registered nurse in 1962. She pulled night shifts at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Des Moines, and years later she shared many memories of caring for combat veterans who served in the European and Pacific theaters of World War II and the Korean War. In the early 1980s, she returned to school and obtained a Bachelor of Science in Professional Arts degree in Healthcare Administration at St. Joseph's College in Standish, Maine. Kathy is survived by her children James and Carla Dugan of North Liberty, Iowa, Joseph and Renee Dugan of Lincoln, Nebraska, Paula and Brian Massey of Olathe, Kansas, and Patricia and Brian Korsnowski of Olathe, siblings and in-laws Phil and Cindy Crowley of West Des Moines, Jerry Crowley of Raytown, Missouri, Margaret and Jean McKellery of Des Moines, Bob and Mary Crowley of Pueblo, Colorado, Francis Beneke of Buena Vista, Colorado, and Patrick Crowley and Wilma Lucenti of Pottstown, Pennsylvania. Kathy was preceded in death by her husband, sister Mary Schmidt, brother Jim, sister-in-law Alice Crowley, and brother-in-law Dennis Beneke. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to Catholic Charities of the Diocese of Sioux City, 1601 Military Road, Sioux City, Iowa. Sidney J. Hoover, 95, of Sioux City, passed away on Monday, August 1st, at Sunrise Retirement Home. He was born the son of Sidney L. and Eleanor Raker Hoover, on July 8, 1927, in Chancellor, South Dakota. Following graduation from Central High School in Sioux City in 1945, he enlisted into the United States Navy. On April 30, 1950, he was united in marriage to Lois C. Hollister in Sioux City at First Presbyterian Church. Sidney worked in the abstract business for 49 years until his retirement in 1995. Sidney is survived by his daughters, Nancy LeBrun, Janet Smothers, and Carol Weatherow. Grandchildren, Sarah LeBrun Jongling, Jim Weatherwax, and David LeBrun. He is also survived by five great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife Lois, sister Beverly Cummings, and son-in-law Denny Smothers. Joanne Elaine Getch Johnson of Sioux City, 90 years old, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, August 3rd, 2022, at a Sioux City hospital after a illness in battling dementia during her last years. She was born on April 21, 1932, in Sioux City to Martin and Leslie Picott Getch. Her siblings were Roland Getch, Beverly Getch Junk, Marvin Getch, Jerry Getch, and Roger Getch. She married Conrad Connie Johnson on July 27, 1951, in Sioux City, and together they had three children, Kathy Johnson Gastro, Margie Johnson, and Roger Johnson. She is survived by her brother, Roger Getch, and his wife, Nancy, daughter, Kathy Johnson Gastro, son, Margie Johnson, son, Roger Johnson, and his wife, Cindy Wheelock Johnson. She is also survived by 8 grandchildren, Autumn Johnson Swayzak, Dan Gastro and Hillary Rice, Sam Gastro, Miles Johnson, and wife Stacia Johnson, Sage Johnson and fiancé Paul Homestead, Bailey Johnson, and husband Josh Johnson, Ross Johnson and Marissa Williams, Jamie Johnson Monin and her husband Kirby Monin. She is also survived by 10 great-grandchildren, Melanie, Madeline, Riley, Avery, Harper, Finn, Maddie, Peyton, Cora, and Ruby. Joanne was preceded in death by her parents, husband, brothers, and their wives, Roland and Mary Brown Getch, Marvin and Blanche Spender Getch, and Jerry and Mary Baker Getch. She's also preceded in death by her sister Beverly Getch and Claire Junick, many nieces and nephews who were all very cherished and loved, and special friends Tom and Carlene Schrader, Don and Jerry Harbeck, and Ron Ruhr. Matthew Stephen Short, 45, of Sioux City, passed away Sunday, July 31, 2022, at Avra McKinnon Hospital in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, surrounded by family. Matt was born on April 16, 1977, in Sioux Falls, to Stephen and Deborah Putnam Short. He graduated from Canton High School in 1995 and continued his education at Doan University in Crete, Nebraska. He was active in football, track and field, and a member of the Alpha Omega fraternity, where he served as vice president before graduation in 2002. After graduation, he moved to Minneapolis, Minnesota, where he co-owned a mortgage company, First Liberty Home Loans. In 2005, he moved back to Sioux City and joined the family business, J&L Staffing, where he worked his way up to vice president of the company. Matt was best known for being a family man, and on June 14th of 2001, his life changed forever with the birth of his beautiful daughter, Maitland. He loved nothing more in the world than being her dad. Matt and Bridget Plattenberger met in the spring of 2020, and he knew from the beginning she was the one. They became united in marriage on June 4, 2022, at their family lake home on Silver Lake, where they shared some of their best memories. He was truly the best father, husband, son, brother, and uncle to his family. He is survived by his wife Bridget Short of Sioux City, daughter Madeline Short of Sioux City, parents John and Debbie Walkenfuss of Sioux City, sister Jennifer and husband Heath Colburn of Sioux City, brother Joshua and wife Ann Short of Sioux City, brother-in-law Ryan and wife Elizabeth Plattenberger of Rochester, Minnesota, nieces and nephews Emily, Aiden, Tess, Liam, Ava, Sophia, and Grace, and many aunts and uncles and cousins. Matt was preceded in death by his father, Stephen Short, and maternal and paternal grandparents. Anthony A. Tony Vondrak of Merrill, Iowa, 62 years old, passed away on Thursday, August 4th at a local hospital. He was born on November 29, 1959 in Merrill, Iowa, to Robert and Irene Vondrak. He was a lifelong resident of Marl and graduated from Hinton Community Schools in 1978. He later earned a two-year degree from WITCC in Sioux City, Iowa. On March 21, 1987, he married Chris Spencer in Sioux City. He was a hard-working farmer throughout his life and farmed with his brothers on the family farm in Merrill. He found enjoyment in combining and baling on the farm. Tony's passions included John Deere, Ford, and spending time with his grandchildren. Tony and Chris were parishioners of St. Joseph of Ellendale. He is survived by his wife, Chris Vondrack, son, Joel, and Aubrey Vondrack, grandchildren, McKenna, Crew, and a new grandson coming in November, brother Bob, his wife, Lucille Vondrack, sisters Donna Darwin Dirks, Eddie and Doug Prewitt, Jane McDougall, Julie Dwayne Jolfs, and Roxanne Merlin Wagner. Brother-in-law, Gary and Carol Goble. Mother-in-law, Fab Spinner. Brothers-in-law, Bill and Cindy Spinner. And Tony and Anita Spinner. Sisters-in-law, Mickey and Randy Nelson. Robin and Dave Marks and Sandy Vondrack. He's also survived by numerous nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, brothers Eddie and Tom Vondrack, sister Beverly Goble, brother-in-law Roger Weck, father-in-law Donald Spinner, and nephew Zachary McDougall. Memorial donations may be directed to the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. And now turning to the opinion page on the Sioux City Journal newspaper, dated August the 10th, headline for this letter to the editor, short and sweet, "Thank you, teachers." Where did the summer go? Soon it'll be time for the students to return to their schools. In addition to their family and friends, they will need the help of the entire educational team, teachers, administration, and support staff. It has been a difficult time for many of them with COVID, budget cuts, short staffing, and increasing disagreements over social and cultural issues. Our public schools are the backbone of the education system that teaches the next generation the history, the facts, and how to be good, thoughtful citizens. And the headline for this opinion piece, "The staggering toll of fentanyl. Mass shootings are awful." But what about fentanyl poisonings? Why do poisoning deaths caused by illegal drugs get so little national news coverage compared to deaths caused by mass shootings? How many illegal drug poisoning deaths get noticed? Here are a few uncomfortable facts. In 2020, there were 19,384 gun murders in the U.S. In 2020, there were 615 mass shootings in the United States, which resulted in 521 deaths. If, in 2020, the mass shooting caused 521 deaths, 18,863 Americans were murdered in other shootings, other than mass shootings. 97.3% of the murder victims murdered with guns were not victims of mass shootings. In 2020, fentanyl killed 57,834 Americans. In 2021, that number jumped and fentanyl killed 71,238 Americans. And according to Pew Research in 2020, the most recent year for which complete data is available, 45,220 people died from gun-related injuries in the United States, according to the CDC. And that figure includes primarily gun murders and suicides, but it also includes three other less common types of gun-related deaths. In 2020, 54% of all gun-related deaths were suicides. A total of 24,294 suicides. In 2020, 43% of all gun-related deaths were murders, bringing a total of 19,384 murders. And of the remaining 2020 gun deaths, 535 were unintentional, 611 involved law enforcement, and 400 were from undetermined circumstances. And so on a per capita basis, there were 13.6 gun deaths per 100,000 people in 2020. Now that's the highest rate since the mid-1990s, but still well below the peak of 16.3 gun deaths per 100,000 people, which was reported back in 1974. And so provisional data from CDC's National Center for Health Statistics indicate that synthetic opioids like fentanyl accounted for 71,238 deaths in 2021. 57,834 deaths in 2022. But fentanyl killed 71,238 Americans in the year 2021. And that staggering number of fentanyl deaths is only 5,533 deaths less than the 76,768 deaths caused by gun murders, meth, and cocaine combined. And so when you look at all of these, the Americans killed by illegal drugs, six times as many Americans were killed by fentanyl, meth, and cocaine as were murdered by guns. The U.S. Customs and Border Patrol website tells us that the eight South Texas ports of entry during the year beginning October 1, 2020 and ending September 30th of 2021 saw a 1,066% increase in fentanyl seized. And the DEA states that 2.5 pounds of fentanyl has the potential to kill 500,000 people. The CDC says a 3-milligram dose of fentanyl is enough to kill an average adult male. Fentanyl, according to the CDC, is up to 100 times more potent than morphine and many more times more potent than heroin. And drug dealers are mixing fentanyl with other drugs such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, and others. Well, every time there is a mass shooting, President Biden and his minions all over the television demanding gun control and the banning of certain weapons. Proposals that ignore the fact that most criminals use guns that are stolen or purchased on the black market. But nearly four times as many Americans are being killed by fentanyl as are being murdered by guns. When it comes to fentanyl, President Biden is back in his basement. Where is Joe Biden's actions to stop fentanyl, cocaine, meth, and heroin from flooding across our open southern border? How many Americans have to die so that the Mexican drug cartels can become richer, more destructive? How hard is it for the cartels, in the absence of Mr. Trump's proposed border wall, to run illegal drugs into the U.S. between our points of entry? When it comes to doing deeds to protect American lives from drugs, America appears to have a feckless, uncaring president. President Biden has said that the stopping transportation of fentanyl across our southern border is a matter of national defense. Now it's time for his deeds to match his words. Talk is cheap. And again, that letter to the editor was written by John Donald O'Shea. He's in Moline. He is a retired circuit judge, and he is a regular columnist. And now switching gears to some sports, college sports, five questions the Iowa Hawkeyes football team must answer. Who will catch on at receiver? Iowa has no shortage of questions and answers at the skill positions on offense. Incumbent Spencer Petras and backup Alex Padilla open fall camp 1-2 at quarterback, where competition is ongoing between two players with starting experience. Gavin Williams and LaShawn Williams appear positioned as the top two options at running back following the early exit of Tyler Goodson. Iowa returns experience in Sam Laporta at tight end and Monty Pottenbaum at fullback. Who will become the next good story up front? Question number two. Injuries impacted the level of experience and consistency Iowa anticipated from its offensive line last season, providing a young group with an opportunity to grow. For the Hawkeyes to truly show improvement on offense, the ability of Logan Jones to follow Tyler Linderbaum's seamless transition from defensive tackle to center will be big. Question number three. Will Iowa's pass rush improve? The Hawkeye defense did a lot of good things a year ago and returned six starters among its front seven. That gives Iowa an opportunity to improve in one area that would complement the depth and experience the Hawkeyes return on the back end of the defense in improved pass rush. Iowa's defensive linemen have mentioned that reportedly during recent months as something they are working on, hoping to increase both the number of sacks and the level of havoc they can create for opposing quarterbacks. Number four, who will make cash count? Before breaking his collarbone during the first week of camp with the NFL's New York Giants, Dane Belton displayed why he became so valuable for Iowa in its cash position on defense. With Belton's move to the next level, the Hawkeyes have a need at the hybrid linebacker/safety position that is helping Iowa successfully deal with the spread offenses that have become commonplace. Sophomore Cooper DeJohn may be the answer at that position. After making an impact during the second half of the season as a true freshman last fall, DeJohn tops the depth chart at the cash spot heading into fall camp. He has the strength to play like a linebacker and run defense and is athletic enough to work as a pass defender. And the final question mark for the Iowa Hawkeyes football team, who will become a consistent kicker. Over the past five seasons, Iowa has played 17 games decided by 6 points or less, magnifying the importance of having a reliable place kicker. Caleb Shudak, Keith Duncan, and Miguel Ranquinos have provided that reliability in recent seasons. But Iowa enters fall camp with ongoing competition between kickers who have not attempted a kick in a college game. And again, well, hard to believe. It's really close to football season. We now have less than a month. Iowa Hawkeyes begin the season on September 3rd at home when they host Iowa State. Then two more home games right in a row. September the 7th, Iowa plays host to Iowa State. And then on September the 17th, Iowa's home against Nevada. Well, looking at the clock, that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, August the 10th. I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. And you know, you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.